for a variety of reasons, in terms of kind of what's happening globally right now with regard to concerns about a novel new virus that's kind of making the rounds, that is getting, I'd say, very uneven treatment in the news media and by government leaders as well, but giving rise to uncertainty, to concern, to some anxiety. Where do you run to for safety when there's that kind of thing abroad in the land, right? And that's something that's been on my mind in part because of what I've been doing for the last few weeks, which is beating a hasty retreat from February in Denver. And so I'm subject to seasonal affective disorder now that I'm retired. I grew up in the Sonoran Desert. So I go down there every February now that I have the opportunity just to hang out in the desert and remember what that's like. It's, you know, it's I live way out in a rural area west of Tucson, and it's sort of been a place of refuge for me over the years. So I got to thinking about that, and there's some aspects of my last visit down there I wanted to share. But to provide a little context, I wanted to share a passage of a book that I know that I've shared in here several times before, but I want to provide a little bit of additional context tonight. And that is an author, a physician named Rachel Rimmon, and this passage I'll be reading is from her book, Kitchen Table Wisdom. And she was a physician who had practice privileges at the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center, and then fell ill with a serious life-threatening disease. And she was treated there at UCSF for some time before she managed to finally begin to recover. And she understood as a physician that the health care that she was getting was about as good as it gets, that there is nothing whatsoever wanting or lacking about all the efforts that all these highly trained professionals were exerting to cure her of her illness. And yet she said, coming out of the experience, that nonetheless felt that there was something missing. Because all of the emphasis had been on curing. And coming out of that experience, I mean, she's enormously grateful to have regained her health, but she went on this quest to find out what it is that had kind of been missing. And what she came to discover is what she distinguishes, makes the distinction between curing and healing. And the latter word has a very different etymology and a very different connotation, actually a very different meaning. Okay. Cure means to be able to rid the body of the symptoms of illness, essentially. Healing means to make whole, to bring together in a whole and integrated way. And what she said she felt as a result of her illness and surviving her illness, profound gratitude for having her health restored. And yet, at the same time, this sense of not really being put back together again. That somehow or another, her being was to some degree disintegrated by having been so ill. And there is a spiritual component to the illness that was never really addressed in a way that she felt it was going to be really important to do. And so coming out of that experience, she changed the nature of her practice. And she started focusing much more of her practice on people who had, were going through the same kind of experiences that she had, who were facing life-threatening illnesses from which they may or may not recover, from which they may or may not be cured. But at the same time, whatever happened with regard to prognosis and outcome, that there was a sense of having been healed or made whole within the context of the experience. And so, in this passage in her book, she's writing about that distinction. She says, in a book about Spain, I remember reading an interesting thing about bullfighting. There's a place in the bull ring where the bull feels safe. If he can reach this place, he stops running and can gather his full strength. He's no longer afraid. From the point of view of his opponent, he becomes dangerous. This place in the ring is different for every bull. It's the job of the matador to be aware of this, to know where sanctuary lies for each and every bull, and to be sure the bull does not occupy his place of wholeness. In bullfighting, the safe place is called the querencia. And I looked that up in my Spanish dictionary, and the literal translation is a place where wild animals go to be safe. It's like their place of refuge or sanctuary in the wilderness. Okay. In bullfighting, a place is called the querencia. For humans, the querencia is a place in our inner world. Often it is a familiar place that has not been noticed until a time of crisis. Sometimes it is a viewpoint, a position from which to conduct a life different for each person. Often it is simply a place of deep inner silence. In working with people with cancer, I have seen the change which happens when a person finds their cadencia. In full view of the matador, they are calm and peaceful and wise. They have gathered their strength around them. The inner silence is more secure than any hiding place. And she lives in Marin County on the backside of the Mount Tamalpais, near the border of Muir Woods National Monument. She said, perhaps this is why the silence in the giant redwood forest near my home draws me. Many mornings I get up early and dress hurriedly to go to the woods before the tour buses and the cars arriving with all the people from all over the world come to marvel at the majesty of nature. At 8 in the morning, the great trees stand rooted in a silence so absolute that one's inmost self comes to rest. An aged silence, the grandmother of silences. I find the silence even more remarkable than the trees. Some mornings I sleep through 2 alarms and awaken only after the first buses have arrived. I go anyway. There are hundreds of people in the woods before me, people speaking French, German, Spanish, people marveling to each other and calling to their children in Japanese, Swedish, Russian, and some languages I do not know, and children shrieking in the universal language of childhood. But the silence is always there, unchanged. It is impervious to these passing sounds as the trees themselves. As I age, I am grateful to find that a silence has begun to gather in me, coexisting with my tempers and my fears, unchanged by my joys or my pain, sanctuary, connected to the silence everywhere. So when I'm down in the desert, one of the things that I do, as I have done since childhood, when we were living up in the mountains, as I go out into the desert in the evenings, just usually about a half hour or so before sunset, and just go for a walk, you know, either riding my horse or going out with my dog, just to be alone in the desert. And the very kind of silence that she was talking about is also very available in that setting in the rural area. And all you really hear is the sort of the coo of the doves and a few other kind of deserty sounds, and it's really quiet and really peaceful. And so I had an opportunity to have out in the some special areas that I am very familiar with, out in the desert, the same kind of experience that she was describing in that passage. And yet, as I was spending time sitting on a rock someplace out in the, you know, in the mountains at sunset, there were memories and insights that began to arise. I would flip in and out of these states of mind that I had been experiencing actually, you know, since, you know, relatively early childhood, and certainly through my teenage years alone in the desert, that were not unlike some of the deep samadhi states that, you know, happen in Buddhist practice. This absolute silence where the feeling of self kind of evaporates and there's no difference between you and that which is around you. But the memories that began to come back with increasing freshness were what it was that sent me out into the desert in the first place. My folks came into a small inheritance, and instead of spending it on a house down in Tucson, they bought land up in the mountains and built a house out of sight of anyone else. It was a pretty remote setting. And it was stunningly beautiful, but we were also very cut off from town, from other people, from my friends from school, or there just wasn't much out there but us, you know, and our horses and our dogs and in the desert. At the same time, my parents' marriage was beginning to disintegrate. And they were in constant conflict over things like money and educating the kids, and I was going to really dangerous, you know, rough inner city schools. And the tension got so bad that, and it was always worse right after my dad came home from work. And so I'd come home from school, I'd do homework for a while, and then a little before the time I know he was usually gonna get home from work, I'd leave because I didn't wanna be in the house when my parents started their, you know, evening version of the Cold War. And so then as I was sitting out in the desert, you know, first just enjoying this stunning, selfless experience of being in the Sonoran Desert, these memories came back and I realized why I'd been out there in the first place. Because, you know, I was well enough experienced in being in the desert and steering clear of all the people, you know, all the little creepy crawlies that could put the hurt on you. And I felt safer in the desert than I did at home, basically. And so I was escaping into the desert for sanctuary, for a cadencia, a place to go to be safe from the turmoil that was occurring in my own family. And then on seeing that, I realized that in some ways, I had become really attached to the desert as this place of sanctuary, as this place to run to, you know, when things were really getting rough at home. And then, just as Rachel says in that passage in her book, another insight that came to me was that, you know, the desert is a stunning place to be, you know, at any time. But the real refuge was the one that was within. You know, even though I was experiencing loneliness and anxiety about what was happening to the family, I could experience those things in this setting that was one that felt like I was being supported or comforted or held in some way, you know. few years ago, I was running a program for the National Park Service where I would train American Indian College students to serve as cultural resource interpreters at the Parks and Monuments in the Mountain West. And a Navajo student that was in my program was doing programs down at Oconweep and the National Monuments down there, told me that there's a valley in northeastern Navajo Reservation where from the time the first Navajo showed up there, there was a war party that was going out. They take him to this valley, and they say, as you go forth into battle, remember this place. Some part of you will always be here. When you're out there, remember this. Some part of you will always be in this place. And he said that ritual is carried down to the present day. When the American Indians have the highest enlistment rates of any ethnic group in the U.S. military. And the Navajo code talkers that went to, serve with the Marines and the Army in the Pacific in World War II, they all went there and had this same ritual occur. 4 days after I came home from Vietnam, in August of 1967, I was registering for classes at the University of Arizona in Tucson. A little bit of a shock there. And I hadn't known about this valley at the time, but I'd been in a situation of imminent endangerment for about a year. And then flew home to Tucson, and it was in the evening, and it was a hot August evening, but there'd just been a major thunderstorm come through, and the desert was, drenched in rain, and there's a bush there, the creosote bush, that puts out this incredibly fragrant, rich aroma when it's wet, after a rainstorm. A friend of mine from college named Gary Nabhan wrote a book once called "The Desert Smells Like Rain," and it's a phrase from the Odom language. That's what it means. And so, I'd been getting on off airplanes and getting processed and all that, and then finally the plane lands and the door opens and I sat down the gangplank. I was just overcome by the fragrance of the creosote bushes. There was still lightning striking, and I could see the outlines of the Tucson Mountains and the Catalinas and the Rincons and the Santa Ritas, the four mountain ranges that encircle the San Pedro Valley. And it was like, I'm home. I'm home. My parents' marriage had disintegrated by then, and my mother had moved away, and so there was no home to come back to in terms of the house or anything. But I was back home in the desert, and there was this just profound sense of peace. There was a feeling of safety, So, I think we each have such a place. It may be a physical place, or like Rachel says, it may be more of an internal state where the mind can just come and be at rest, okay, and know its place, know what's going on. And the Buddha actually talked about this a fair amount. There's a book that I'm reading and rereading by a teacher named Gil Fronsdale. He was one of my trainers in my seminary program. It's called The Buddha Before Buddhism. And it's his translation and commentary on what may be the most ancient texts of all the Buddha's 45 years of teaching. The English translation is the Book of Eights. And among the really interesting things about this book and where its title comes from, the term or the concept, the word enlightenment, where that comes from is the first European language translations of the early Buddhist texts. And those occurred at around the time or just after the beginning of the European Enlightenment. And so they were trying, the translators were trying to get some feeling of, what's this Nibbana stuff all about? What does it mean? What does it consist of? Cooling? What's that? You know, cooling? Yeah. That's too simple. That doesn't make, it's not profound enough, right? And so that's where the word enlightenment comes from, you know. The literal translation is cooling. The one that the Buddha actually most often used is awakening, as if awakening from a dream, sort of awakening from the dream of self. And if you've studied a lot of Buddhist texts, you know, especially the actual discourses, what the historical Buddha is actually thought to have said over those 40 years, close to 8,000-9,000 pages of English text, if you decide to do a deep dive, none of that is in the Book of Eights. He never uses the term enlightenment. Awakening, I think maybe once or twice. What he talked about throughout in that translation was peace of mind. Interestingly, okay. How does one come to recognize and relax into peace of mind? And so when people were asking, well, what were you doing out in the boonies, you know, for those 6 years and all these people you sat with and whatnot, he said, I was seeking peace of mind. And he said, the reason I've decided to teach is that I have found peace of mind. And so then the question started coming to him, well, you know, what is your teaching? What is your doctrine? What is, you know, how is this peace of mind to be attained? How is it to be achieved? And this was really when he was first beginning to start to teach, because he didn't even make reference to like a sangha, like a big group of followers or anything. You know, this is really early stuff. So it's quite possible that later on he started spinning out, you know, more stylized or structured teachings in response to demand, because the earliest people to sit with him were people like him who were ardent, inquirers, who were mendicant monks and recluses like himself, or Brahmins, the scholars of the state religion who'd become disaffected with Brahmanism. And so rather than, you know, reeling out the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Seven Factors of Enlightenment and the Five Spiritual Faculties and basically all he talked about was letting go. He said the truth is not to be found in doctrines, and the truth is not to be found in lists and teachings, and it's not to be found in rituals. And it's not to be found in, you know, burning incense and candles and, you know, sacrificing oxen and what. He said it's all about letting go, including letting go of your preconceptions about what it means to wake up. Okay. Letting go of your preconceptions about what it means to even find peace of mind. Because all he was saying to do, he says, just really be with the mind in as clear and relaxed, as gentle a way as you can, and simply observe what the mind is doing. Observe when it is calm and clear and peaceful, and observe when it's troubled, whether by craving or by aversion, whatever happens to be going on. Simply observe what the mind is up to. As the power of simple observation becomes greater, the field within which this is all occurring becomes larger. If you drop a big rock in a little pond, it makes quite a splash and stirs up the mud. If you drop the same size pond in a mountain lake, it's relatively unnoticeable, right? So, and he used the simile of a lake, of a mountain, like a fair mountain, when he's talking about the nature of mind, as its spaciousness, you know. He'd speak about the mind that contains all things and yet is not made up of them, you know. So he essentially, in these very early teachings, is just saying, don't strive for anything. You know, one of his final insights before his awakening and his discovery of this selfless peace of mind, he said, what's going on in this mind? You know, I've been striving so assiduously all these years to attain some state, right? That the very unskillful effort of striving for attainment made it impossible for him to see what was already there. And when he just let go of his notions of what it means to be awakened or what it means to achieve final liberation, just let go. He said, you let go, you know, the truth will become manifest. It's not to be found in any words. It's not to be found in any teachings, including mine. The only place you're going to find the truth is within. And the only place you're going to find this peace of mind I'm talking about is in this moment. And it's to be achieved simply by letting go. That's where the peace of mind lies. And, as it turns out, that's where your own cadencia lies as well. The place of safety is the place of peace. So whatever's going on in our lives, whether it's political stuff or public health stuff, right? That place of safety is not to be found out there anywhere. It's to be found in. And it's really important to understand that this place of safety, this place of peace, does not mean you're not going to get some cruddy disease. And it does not mean that you might not get angry sometimes, or feel despair, or loneliness, or anything else that's painful, right? It doesn't mean those things are not to be experienced. It means they are not to be taken as I, me, or mine. They are simply occurrences in the world. The cadencia is different for each of us depending on the kind of peace the mind is in search of. So for instance, the nucleus of this sangha over 20 years ago now, was from people who had attended some teachings I gave at a regional meeting of all 12-step groups in the greater Denver area. And then I offered an introductory course. And they were very clear about how they had found the, you know, the this path of recovery to be powerful and valuable and healing, but they felt really some obstacle with regard to this heavy-duty theistic orientation. And they were really hoping to find a setting that would support respect for clarity of mind, okay, but without it being necessarily coupled to a theistic perspective. Okay. And one of the things that Buddha Dharma Sanghas really honor and have high regard for and support in every way that we can is clarity of mind and supporting each other in maintaining that clarity. So for people, you know, on the healing path from issues around alcohol use disorder or substance abuse or whatever, the cadencia is sobriety, right? It's where are you going to be safe? And a community of people with whom you share that goal So, for various of us, it can be different places at different times, but only we know where that place lies at any given point in time. It's just really important, I think, based on the Buddha's teachings, to know that it's there, you know, and it's waiting to be discovered, not by, you know, trouncing with a machete through the jungle, you know, like the Raiders of the Lost Ark, but rather just by following the Buddha's advice, you know, be still, look within, free from fear and attachment, know the joy and the peace of this way. Disarmingly simple, isn't it? let's talk. Where's your place of peace? How do you define it? Anything I've said that resonated in any way with you, it would be lovely to talk about it if you want to. Please.
As we were doing our initial meditation, I just come from a difficult meeting and found myself just making up one angry story after another. And then I'd smile at myself and pay attention to the breath. And that would last for about 2 seconds. Yep. And then I had a new angry story. Mm-hmm. And it went on until finally you rang the bell and I could stop being in that angry place. But what's fascinating is so just listening to your voice and hearing you paint a picture of that peaceful place, mm-hmm. I could let go of all the anger.
Okay. Well done. Sometimes I describe this, you know, mindfulness meditation practice as engineering bad reception on HDTV. Because we're watching this seamless drama, you know, all the stuff that was going on in your meeting, and then there's that episode, and here's the next episode. But then all of a sudden, when the reception gets bad, everything gets pixelated, and it breaks up into little colored squares, right? And maybe goes completely fuzzy and whatnot. And that's mindfulness, just kind of cutting through, you know, cutting through the drama or cutting through the, you know, triple X rated movie or the comedy or whatever it is you happen to be watching, right? And so, oh, phooey, you know. And then you're back in the present moment, you know. Like the Buddha said, peace of mind does not lie in the future and it does not lie in the past. It only exists in the moment. And just whether it's the breathing or anything else, you're back there, that's where it is. Thank you. Please.
So, September and October 2004, my aunt was living in Abiquiu, New Mexico.
Yeah.
And she kind of like forced me to come live with her at the time, because the 3 years prior to that, I had been drinking and drugging like crazy. And her thought was to get me down there to work on a property and do something, and she would leave me alone on the mesa down there for like 10 hours a day. Uh-huh. And I remember like, the, you know, going through DTs and all that stuff,
yeah.
And terror, like it was,
yeah,
very terrifying out there. But
yeah.
It is, there's no noise other than whatever noises do exist, but it was, I remember being completely paralyzed some days by it. And then other days there was like this carencia thing you were talking about,
yeah,
because she had me stay at a woman friend of hers down in the mesa that had a house that was hardly ever there.
Uh-huh.
And so I stayed, and she had this California king size bed over this outcropping, and there was these lightning storms and stuff.
Yeah.
I lasted about a month and a half out there, and I got on a Greyhound bus to the first liquor store, good.
Yeah.
It didn't last, but it was, I always think back, and I've been able to go back to that property since then, and it, even though I was terrified most of the time, there is this feeling of like love for that. Like,
yeah, beautiful. Thank you so much for expressing it in that way. Part of the recovery process seems to almost inevitably include a certain sense of vulnerability, you know, of kind of nakedness, to the extent that we may have been using some substance or alcohol or whatever to try to form some kind of a shield or a barrier or a protective cocoon, right? Try to keep the mind in a particular state, you know, and then all of a sudden you're not doing that anymore. It can really be frightening, very anxiety provoking, because you've robbed yourself of that. And I think it takes a while for it to sink in, and obviously it has for you from the way you describe it, to realize that it wasn't a protective cocoon, it was a prison. Yeah. It was a self-constructed prison that we were afraid to leave. But then the walls come tumbling down, and you're a hell of a lot freer than you wanted to be. Shit, oh dear, it's just me in the desert. Oh, this is freaky. But nonetheless, I mean, just as you described, were hugely important steps. You know, when the space is big enough, like out on the mesa or whatever, you know, there's the lightning bolt, you know, there's the terror, but then there's this astonishing beauty and this peace of mind, you know, it's there along with everything else. Thanks a lot for, yeah, please.
Well, that reminds me of letting go of self-concepts too, that served as a shield and as a dream to not face reality. Because, and that's been part of my journey in meditation, is letting go of these old self-concepts. And I'll tell you, it's when they're gone, it's kind of scary.
Absolutely.
Like, who am I really?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, whether it's surrendering reliance on something that creates the illusion of invulnerability, or surrendering the self-images, the means by which we self-identified it, or when the samadhi gets really deep, surrendering the notion that there's even anybody home, you know, there is a fear element in all of those, and a kind of a vulnerability. Okay. And in my experience, recognizing that for what it is, and being with it anyway, this path really requires faith and courage. It does, you know. Faith in ourselves, faith in each other, you know, in the Sangha, and faith in the lived experience of the teaching, right? When the fear is happening, fear and the future are inextricably intertwined. Fear is always about something that may or may not happen in the future. If I don't project this image that I've cultivated over the years, who am I? Will I disempower myself? Will people think I'm goofy or slow if I don't immediately, you know, come forth in a way that I've been accustomed to doing, instead of maybe taking a breath and reflecting on how I want to respond in a given situation? It's to really live the Dharma is to live in the immediacy of the moment, you know, in a way that most of us really aren't accustomed to, you know. It gets easier with practice, and I think we become more trusting of ourselves with practice. And there are other qualities of mind when we've got that when we relax into and trust the moment and trust in our ability to know what is true, okay, it becomes evident, I think, that what that very practice is, what it does, it's an exercise in self-compassion. You know, to be able to just be in the moment and trust the moment, trust your instincts, you know, that you will come forth and be the person you need to be at any given point in time, instead of, you know, playing a preconceived role, but rather realize that you are literally making yourself up as you go along anyway. So why not be honest about it? You know? So there's something that's really kind of precious and noble and scary and courageous about just trusting that how you are in any given moment will be okay. And that comes from a place of, you know, self-confidence in the deepest sense of the word, you know, spiritual intuition. And from a place of self-care, from a place of self-compassion, of kind of holding yourself as a loving parent might a child, okay? Because it's the child that's afraid, right? The one that is afraid that they aren't going to be cared for, they aren't going to be held, they aren't going to be literally safe. So that's what we're doing. We're creating that place of safety within. And from that place, all things become possible. Thanks. Please, anything else?
I just would add, you know, that might seem a little negative, but from my experience, letting go with some of that, some of those things, those crutches, those unnecessary acts, does not lead to instant feeling better. Mm-hmm. It seems to have been lead to a long time of sort of feeling rootless and down.
Yes. Right. Thank you. Right. It's not all going to be sweetness and light. Oh, here I am in the moment. Ta-da! It is being there for what this moment has to offer, and the next moment, and the next moment, and the next. When I was sitting out there in the desert, you know, there were these feelings of peacefulness, and then I was holding a frightened child, you know, and that time in the desert for me didn't turn out to be all fun and games, you know, because I'd go out there and I'd feel like I was being haunted, you know, by, you know, it was pretty unhappy childhood, you know, getting bullied at school. I was like, you know, that whole part of my life, I don't have a whole lot of real fond memories, and I have memory of a fair amount of trauma, right? And so being back there, you know, I certainly felt the presence of and the kind of being held by just the, sort of the spirit of the desert, but it was no protection whatsoever from these powerful feelings. It was just, there was a certain catharsis in being able to be with them on a moment-to-moment basis as they arose and passed. And so I think that's one way to think about, you know, the letting go and then feeling the doubt, whether it's self-doubt or doubt of the path or anything else, just misgivings, anxiety, you know, whatever. There's something about just being with each of those feelings as they're happening that I think can be quite cathartic, you know. It because the experiencing of them in a really truthful and upfront way is to also let them go. You know, when I was like feeling sad or whatever, I realized that what was making, as we all kind of know by now, at least up here, is that when the difficult or afflictive emotions arise, and then the thought, I wish I weren't feeling these. And, you know, we know that only makes it worse, you know, rather than just being with the unpleasant to the extent we can without aversion, the pleasant without clinging. And eventually it feels like the system kind of rids itself of this, not of the unpleasant experiences, but of the aversion to them. You know? And we're talking about equanimity at a really deep level here. You know? And it's interesting with this Book of Eights, you know, the Buddha, that's where he started off with. He started off with equanimity and nothing else. Very simple, very straightforward. And then there were all these years of, you know, all these teachings and doctrines and sangha building and whatnot. And then in the end, when he was dying, it was just still the same thing. It's all about letting go. Just don't ever forget that. But thank you for pointing that out, that this process of letting go, trusting the moment, does not lead to a life of unalloyed bliss. But it does, in my experience, lead to a life that is, to some extent, really imbued with courage, you know, with courage and an understanding that at some deep level I know what is true, and I'm willing to live my life moment to moment on that basis. That's pretty powerful. I think it's worth the effort. Okay. Well, we've gone and done it. I hope that you feel that our time is well spent. Let's settle in for just a moment. Or one last little time together. Allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. May we all live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we rest together in a field of self-understanding, of self-compassion, of compassion for each other. And of deep, selfless peace of mind. Thanks for dropping by. See you in a couple of weeks.